You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 8th of February 2014 on Monocle 24.
From the wintry waters of the Baltic to the great southern seas, fashion editorial from a Swedish brand with an independent streak, and an Antipodean magazine that hits the waves, taking in the arts as it goes. Coming up on today's programme, we get an insight on a title that's become a benchmark of discretion and good taste, a magazine produced by one fashion brand, but that admits a vision of editorial independence. We'll be looking at Acne Papers, beautiful new edition, with a man who knows it very well. And we'll be swapping hemispheres as we go to urbane, often rainy Melbourne, an unlikely place you might think to start a surf magazine.
And we just kind of wanted to do something that wasn't super saturated in surf content, so that's why, I mean, we've obviously got a lot of surf in there, but we don't strongly identify as being a surf mag.
All that and plenty more besides on this 76th edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards, here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House for this edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Duncan Campbell is the editor of award-winning fashion and culture publication Acne Paper. He also works as a writer and creative director specialising in book design, branding and image creation for heritage brands and individuals with a story to tell. Duncan, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for coming in. Good to have you with us. Talk to me a little bit about Acne Paper. We both have a copy of this very handsome and, I must say, very well-regarded journal with us. Talk to me a little bit about the sort of the overarching direction, because I guess one thing you do have with this is a lot of time to kind of get it right and do exactly what you want to do with each edition. How does that work? What's the sort of creative process that goes into each fresh issue?
I think what we have is that we have time, and also we have the opportunity to have a lot of freedom in what we put in the magazine. It's biannual. But we don't base it on, you know, we don't base it on a specific schedule of fashion weeks like a lot of publications when they have a spring and a fall issue to coincide with the new collections. We don't work that way. We work in a sort of it's ready when it's ready in a scenario, if possible. But I suppose the overarching profile for the magazine is about combining the historical and the contemporary. It's about finding new ways to tell stories. It's about finding little hidden pockets of stories that perhaps people thought they knew about, but you can sort of find something new. And each issue is based on the theme. The themes are very broad. So in the past, they've included things like eroticism or eclecticism or elegance. So, you know, you can imagine you can go quite wide with those types of themes. But what we try to do is to try and treat them from every angle we can, and also to sort of put our own spin on it, I suppose.
And tell me a little bit about the sort of, editorial standpoint, the kind of editorial independence you have, because, you know, Acne is quite interesting, isn't it, as a sort of brand overall. There's a lot of these titles we're used to seeing which are sort of offshoots of fashion brands. They're very directly sort of promotional, but that's not at all the sort of ethos here, is it? That must be something that's quite, liberating for you to be working within.
I think so. I mean, we're very lucky to be able to make it, and it takes a huge amount of, I suppose, confidence and also vision from a brand like Acne to want to, you know, put money into a project like this. What we did, or what the magazine did in the beginning that's interesting, is, you know, nowadays, I suppose, it's quite common for brands to have magazines. In fact, most of them do. But what Acne Paper did at the beginning was to make a magazine that wasn't about, you know, Acne said, let's make a magazine, but let's not make it just about how cool we are. Let's make it about the world at large. And, you know, instead of saying, look at us, we're great, and we make jeans and we make clothes and isn't that great? They thought, let's make a magazine that says, well, isn't Rembrandt interesting? Or isn't Noam Chomsky interesting? Or isn't David Lynch interesting? And I think it comes a bit, the Swedes have a sort of inbuilt humbleness that you know, I'm not Swedish, but I've worked with them for a long time. And that's something that you come to understand about them. They don't like to sing, make a song and dance about how great they are. And I think that's part of where this came from. It was saying, you know, we are part of a discussion, you know, that recently, of course, the brand has sort of grown enormously. But in those days, you know, 8 or 9 years ago when the magazine started, it was about saying, we want to explore a different avenue of media, which was print, and here's the things we want to talk about.
And now talk to us a little bit about the actual journal itself, because I said it's a handsome tome. This is the 15th issue, so 2014, the first of these. Wonderful combination. You've got some beautiful full bleed images. It was interesting you said about the sort of historical side of things, because a lot of, are they almost like heritage images? I don't know how you describe them. Very almost something pleasingly traditional about them. Is that something that you're very sort of consciously trying to do, to have that sort of, I don't want to say sort of retro, but there is an almost a kind of timeless quality to it, I think.
I mean, I think timeless is what we try. We'd hope for. You know, you'd hope to be able to look at this in 5 or 10 years' time, and it's still to be as relevant as it is now, because we're trying to tell stories that, you know, it's not about news, you know, because we make 2 magazines a year. If you do news stories, then by the time the magazine comes out, then it's no longer news. So we don't do shopping pages, we don't do news stories, we don't do, you know, who's hot and who's not, because that's not what it's about. It's about trying to tell stories that will be interesting at whatever moment. In terms of this issue, we focused on the theme of the actress, and it was about sort of the cult of the woman and the cult of the actress. So right from, you know, the mid-19th century to the current day, history has always played a huge part in what we do, but it's not about being nostalgic and saying things used to be great and now they're miserable. It's about saying, I think it's just about telling the whole spectrum. And when you look at, when we talk about historical things, it's also about putting them in a context that can be understood through today's lens, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I just wonder then, when you're sort of describing Annie Paper to those who are perhaps unfortunate enough not to be familiar with it already, do you describe it as a cultural title then, a fashion title? Does it trouble you if people say, oh yes, Annie Paper, I know, the big fashion magazine. Does that concern you?
It doesn't trouble me. I mean, people can call it what they like, I think.
As long as they say something
I think
nice.
It looks like a fashion magazine because it's big, and we take a lot of time over the printing, the repro, and we are lucky enough to have some really fantastic world-class photographers who have been kind enough to participate, but I think we sort of call it a fashion and culture magazine, I suppose. I mean, it's if you look inside, it's extremely wordy. And we spend a lot of time, you know, with the interviews and the prose, not only, you know, making it make sense, but also making it, you know, with the typography and the typesetting. That's a big part of it. So I'd say the way it differed from a fashion magazine was that it actually has things to read, rather than just things to look at.
Absolutely. Well, we commend you on that side of things, Duncan. Absolutely. Just briefly, I mean, it's interesting. There's some other launches that we've seen. Net-a-Porter, for example, have their Porter magazine, which is coming out. As you mentioned already, that a lot of brands have kind of gone into this sort of territory, which they find very interesting. Are you sort of encouraged if you see brands? How do I put this delicately? Not ripping off the idea, but do you see tributes on the newsstand when you look at other titles? Does that please you, or does it frustrate you that people are taking cues from the good work that you've already done before?
I mean, I don't think it frustrates me at all. I think, you know, I suppose in many ways nothing is new, and, you know, we've sort of everything is a reference of something else. But, you know, of course you can see graphic references to, I suppose, Acne Paper, but then you can see lots of references where Acne Paper came from. I mean, there's Brodovich and Vogue in the 50s, and there's all kinds of, you know, using Dido for the masthead. You know, every major fashion magazine for the last 100 years has used Dido for a masthead. So I wouldn't claim that there was the things that people stole, but I would like to think that there are certain signatures that people haven't been inspired by, like full bleed images, like having big, exciting typography, trying to not make things too, I suppose, graphic designy, if that makes sense. You know, not over designed things. I didn't design the magazine, but we worked very closely with our art directors in Sweden, and, you know, it's a lot about giving things space to breathe, giving text space, letting the images talk for themselves, and without having to overwork it, I think.
Just briefly on that point, that sort of collaborative process with the influence from Sweden, as you mentioned, with the graphics and other sort of editorial staff, is that a nice process then to have it sort of spread around? Because a lot of people are used to a very sort of intense crucible of creation behind a magazine where everyone's in one room and you know, bounce ideas off one another. This is a bit more, it's certainly a little more patient in the build-up, as you say, and it's spread fairly wide. What's that process like? Is it, I guess it's probably encourages ideas to develop in perhaps a slightly different way.
I mean, the way the magazine did work previously, we had Thomas Pearson as the editor-in-chief, and myself and Charlotte Ray, who are the two editors, and we sit together in London and we work on the editorial and the commissioning, and then we have Matthias Carson, who's a fashion director, and he's really in charge of the fashion element, so the shoots and who styles it and who photographs it. And that's it, really, for the full-time editorial staff. The design is taken care of by our team in Sweden, and what we tend to do is we go there after the magazine's finished. We tend to go there for a week at the beginning of the design process. We sit with them and we hammer out, I suppose, a skeleton of the way it's going to look. Then we go away and they work on it for 2 weeks. Then we come back for the final week, and then we sort of proofread it and perfect everything. So it's a great process because it's a wonderful opportunity to collaborate with people who are extremely talented, but also to get a fresh point of view. Because as I said, if you're only three or four people working on it the whole time, I mean, we have a fantastic, huge family of contributors in terms of writers and artists and photographers who work with us. But as a core team, it's only three or four. So the Acne head office in Sweden is a fantastic, huge building in the middle of the old town. And there's, you know, there's literally hundreds of people there. So it's quite a change from our way of working here. It makes a nice difference.
It sounds very agreeable. Those are the insights of Duncan Campbell here on The Stack today. We'll be taking more of a look through Acne Paper and delving into some other titles that Duncan has with him in his stack a little later in the programme. Right now, though, we're going to head south to Melbourne.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Now, Melbourne might seem like an unlikely base for a young surfing magazine. After all, the city is more famous for flat whites than raging swells. But that was no obstacle for Andy Summons when he founded Paper Sea Quarterly in 2012. His publication combines a very Melbournean sense of design and culture with a love for all things surf. Monocle's Adrian Craddock spoke with Andy recently about his role in the new wave, see what we've done there, of Australian surf publishers.
The surf industry is a funny one. It's quite small. There's a lot of surf magazines in Australia. And a lot of them, I think, have been around for a long time. And they're really impressive considering they have been around for so very long in what is a relatively small pool compared to, say, America. And we just kind of wanted to do something that wasn't super saturated in surf content. So that's why, I mean, we've obviously got a lot of surf in there, but we don't strongly identify as being a surf mag. But we sort of wanted to do stuff that was, you know, pure travel and pure art without having to tie it back into, you know, the surf industry. So I love the idea of doing a travel feature on Mexico and not having to just stick to talking about the ocean and the beach culture because there's so much else going on.
That's probably the thing that sticks out most about your magazine. I can't think of many other surf mags that would have a feature on board shaping and but then flicking over a little bit further down, have a four-page feature on a ballet dancer.
When it comes to selecting content, we try and publish features that we think surfers and people who enjoy surf culture in the ocean will also appreciate. So that's why we've run features, you know, with illustration artists and ballet dancers and, you know, all sorts of people who would never ever be covered in other surf magazines. And that's sort of indicative of the modern surfer. I mean, they're involved and interested in so much more than just surfing.
When you flick through some of the other surfing mags you're talking about, you kind of get the feeling that surf culture in Australia is fairly macho. So when you run an article like the ballet dancer article that I was talking about, is there a lot of discussion that goes into, you know, whether this might alienate some of our readership?
Yeah, look, it's always a consideration. The last thing we want to do is alienate our readers, but a strong part of our audience are surfers, but because we've got the travel and the art aspect, we've got a really good relationship with the National Gallery of Victoria, so we're sort of doing some really great collaborations with them and some of their exhibiting artists. A lot of our audience is sort of outside the surf community. So we know that we're never going to be able to keep everyone happy all the time. But with something like that, that's something we wanted to do for quite a long time. And so we sort of weighed it up and figured that, yeah, I mean, if people didn't like it, it's only four pages, so they can move on.
Something else that is really impressive about your magazine when you flick through is that it seems like either gender could really appreciate it, which in most cases with other Australian surf magazines is not the case. Is that something that was deliberate, that you really set out to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I kind of like to think of myself as a bit of a feminist. And so just one of the things we try and do, have tried to do from issue one, is remove barriers for female readers. You know, there's no reason for us to run images of half-naked women unless it's part of a nude series, you know, that we've worked on with a, you know, with a photographer or artist. And that's sort of, in our minds, a lot different, you know, running the nude series of artistic portraits as opposed to, you know, sort of half-naked women in bikinis. So that's something that just doesn't really appeal to our audience.
Papers Sea Quarterly, I mean, it's a really catchy title. I think the paper is really important in that. I mean, are you the kind of guy that's really obsessed with magazines, that loves the feel of them and the smell and everything like that that goes with them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from day one, we knew that Paper Sea had to be a print publication. We very easily could have, and we discussed keeping it as just digital, but it was never, yeah, it was literally within one meeting, you know, we raised the point and dismissed it because it's sort of not what we enjoy about, I mean, digital can't provide what we enjoy about surf culture. And there's a lot of photographers out there who, you know, say they're photographers and then don't print any photos. They've just got a whole bunch of files on the computer. And I feel the same way about magazines. Like I think, you know, having digital platforms is great. And there's certain audiences that really appreciate that. But I think certainly for what we're doing, it always had to be a print publication. And coming from a writing background, I feel very strongly about books and paper and having words on those paper. So the sort of tactile nature of Paper Sea is a really important part of it. And we sort of invest quite a bit in the production value so that, I mean, because we come out quarterly, it's quite thick. So it's around 200 pages long. It's about an inch thick. And I mean, that's partly because we make people wait between issues. And so we want to make sure that when the next issue comes, it's really worth the wait and it's worth the premium price tag too. So yeah, we make it really long and make sure that when they finally get it, they can really enjoy the feel of it. And also just the paper stock we've chosen, which is a little bit thicker, uncoated and matte, just makes the images look fantastic. And that's sort of what we really appreciate as well, is being able to provide that for all our contributors whose work we absolutely love and enjoy being able to publish.
That was our Melbourne correspondent, Adrian Craddock, talking to Andy Summons of the surfing and arts magazine, Paper Sea. Still with me, of course, is Duncan Campbell. And Duncan, I've shocked you by passing you several copies of Paper Sea and ask you for an immediate judgment. What do you make of that then? We're hearing a bit about it. Interesting sort of concept. With that in your hand, what's your first instinctive reactions to the cover, to the look, to the feel of Paper Sea?
I think it's lovely. I mean, I think it reminds me immediately of a sort of new breed of magazines that we've seen, I suppose, in the last year or two that have that sort, I mean, not, I wouldn't say twee, but they have a sort of, it's a, let's get out of the city and go camping and cook on a campfire sort of universe that I suppose that people aspire to now. We all sit at a screen all day.
Yeah, it has that sort of, it's a kind of homespun, charming.
Homespun, I suppose, sort of plaid shirt and a pickup truck kind of feel to it. You know, it reminds me a bit of Serial, which I suppose is in that world, and also Kinfolk. But I think it's lovely. I like the combination of recipes. I think the food pics are lovely.
It's a nice feel to it as well, I think. It's nice paper.
Nice paper, nice type. But it strikes me to be in that, I'd sort of put it in that bracket, I suppose.
Because it has a sort of kind of almost washed out, nice kind of surfy look to it, doesn't it?
That's sort of
reminiscent of those magazines you mentioned.
Sort of sun-bleached, I suppose. Mm. No, it's lovely. The paper quality is nice. The print's good.
I think the only worry that occurs to me when I read out the title is it is Paper Sea, but it just sounds a bit like Paper Sea. So people might think it's some kind of a Vatican special interest title, perhaps, but maybe they hadn't thought of that.
Now, perhaps the branching out.
Exactly. Now, Duncan, let's continue by delving into the rest of your stack of magazines. We obviously had a leaf through the most recent Acne paper. That was Paper Sea we were talking about. What else have you got there? I see you've got a range of titles from... What's the range? Is it from the sublime to the ridiculous? Old favourites, new favourites?
I brought three very different ones. I thought rather than bringing magazines that I thought would sound cool to talk about pretending I read them, I actually brought magazines that I do read and I do like, all for very different reasons. Shall I start with this one?
Yeah, start with, you got The World of Interiors there.
I'm sure everyone brings The World of Interiors in this show, but the reason I brought it is because I think it knows exactly what it does and who it's talking to, and it does it very well. And it's not trying to be cool and it's not trying to break boundaries, but I think it is... It's great. It's cozy. I think people love it. I like the way that it straddles the world between being for design professionals and also just for people who like beautiful interiors. Mm. And I just think it does its job very well.
And is it an object lesson, do you think, in sort of not meddling too much with the winning formula? Because it has this very sort of classic cover design, which is largely unchanged, and you can spot it on the newsstand anywhere. And it obviously manages to keep delivering without, as you say, sort of doing anything radical, without trying to kind of shock or take its readers on a particular kind of journey. They know what they like and they do it very, very well. Is that a good lesson, do you think, for editors to maybe, you know, not always try and tweak a winning formula?
I think absolutely. I think it depends a lot on the product. I think, you know, if you're talking to people who, you know, if this is a formula that works, then exactly as you say, why mess with it? But, you know, of course, there's pages I kind of have a look at and think, oh, I'd like to have a stab at that. But I mean, the reason I brought it and the reason I chose it is really for the, it's for the content. It's for the breadth of the kind of, you know, places that they go to. And it's not all about saying country house after country house. There's, you know, there's lots of very ethnic things and there's lots of very rustic things. And the other thing I really love about it is that they have every big story has a pun title, which I have a soft spot for puns.
Well, we are very big fans of the quality pun. Are there any to hand?
There is one here. It's I'm just going to read the blurb a bit. It's about a Argentinian polo player who's built a hut in his forest out of oil drums, and the title for the piece is Drum Roll, of course. Roll spelled R-L-L-E.
That's very good. Well, we should have maybe had a dramatic drum roll before delivering the pun, the coup de grace pun. So great puns, nice photography, good balanced content. That really delivers for you. And that's a mag that, as you say, that you would sort of read month to month. How's your general magazine diet? Do you sort of hit the newsstand and in a frenzy suddenly sometimes go out and grab all the titles that you can pick up just because of the strength of how they look? Or do you tend to sort of gravitate back towards your favourites? Do you have a bit of a staple diet that you stick to?
I have to admit, I don't actually run it to the newsstand. I think when you work in magazines, perhaps you don't need to necessarily overindulge in them in one's spare time. I mean, of course, it's always good to be aware of what other people are doing and to have an eye over the industry in general. But I think also when you work in design, for me anyway, it works to try not to look at too much other work, because I think you absorb it subconsciously and then you start producing things that you forget you've seen before, but you have. So for design, certainly, I try not to look at too many things that would be sort of in a contemporary competitor, I suppose.
Absolutely. Let's move on. Now, you've got The Week. Tell me about The Week. It's an interesting idea, this sort of digest. Is that what you like about it? It makes a kind of convenient way to consume media, given there is so much of it. It's coming to you from all these different sources. It's nice to have something that's a little curated snap. Is that what sort of draws you to it?
Again, it's a sort of a fitness for purpose thing for me. The Week comes on a Friday. It aggregates all the world's news from the previous week, and it does so in a very digestible and understandable way from all the major British and international newspapers. It's something it does from a design point of view. I mean, it's very straightforward, obviously. It's very conservative. But from a design point of view, it does something very well that I perhaps don't necessarily do so well in my work. And I think Monocle does do well, which is to cram a huge amount of information into a small space in a way that's very neat and understandable. So I think from a design point of view, that's why I'd say The Week does really well.
And tell me, in terms of design, because I guess some people might say, well, it does do that, it's conveying a lot of information, but is it an inspiring look to it? Or do you think that sometimes it's good to have these titles that kind of do what they say on the tin? It is a digest, it is about communicating information, so it doesn't have to thrill the designer in you, it can just satisfy the keen mind and the mind eager to learn what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's supposed to thrill the designer in me. I think it's supposed to just to tell you what happened in the last week, and you can pretend you've read all the papers.
Exactly. It's a lot of it is about getting that impression across. Let's continue through your stack. What else have you got? I see something else nestling in there.
So
somewhere.
My third one is one that does thrill the designer in me, which is a magazine called The White Review, which is a quarterly literary review made by two guys based out of London. And it's art directed by a chap called Ray O'Meara, who's someone I really admire in his work. And this is something that it's a literary review, so it's very wordy. But I think the way it's laid out and it's designed is really strong.
It's very beautiful, isn't it? It's a kind of smaller format. It has a sort of bookish quality. Where do you stand on that idea of the magazine almost as the book, as the collectible thing to be, you know, put on the shelf and treasured like a proper volume rather than something that's ephemeral and thrown away? I mean, I guess working on something like Antony Paper, that must be very important to you to have this idea of this sort of curated object that then people will keep and enjoy and treasure for a long time.
Well, when we set out to make something that people will collect, but, you know, both as something they can enjoy reading, but also something they can, you know, keep as an object. And people tend to, you know, if people like the magazine, they tend to try to have them all. And we get a lot of emails, people saying, can you send us, you know, issue 4? And we say, sorry, you have to go on eBay because they're all gone. But the White Review reminds me of that, because it was designed to be collected as a set. This is number 9 I have here. Mm. And if you go on the website, you can read about the principle behind it. It's all funded by donations. It's a non-profit, which I think is also quite interesting. And I suppose the profile behind it is new writing and poetry and, young, you know, long form interviews with interesting people in the arts. Wasn't necessarily content so much that I was excited about, but I think for me, it's not really a magazine, I suppose, it's more of a literary journal, if you want to go in that direction, but it's very bookish, it's almost sort of has a Bible-ish quality to it. I think the chaps who make it have a real sort of sense of what they want to do and who they want to talk to, and I think it works really well.
Interesting you make that point about the sort of funding model, and we talked a little about Acne Paper, the fact that you have these brands who are willing to make investments in things like the printed word. You've got other models like with White Review. Are you satisfied that there is enough opportunity for aspiring people, maybe who want to even start their own magazine? There are these models out there. If people have a good idea and a positive vision and something very clear that they want to communicate, there are enough easy ways to make it happen. You don't despair at times that maybe there's some great voices that are going unheard, or some great design visions that are never realised because of the broad pressures that are on the print sector. Do you feel that it's sort of robust enough to support the visionaries that are out there?
I don't think it's easy by any means to make a new magazine, but one would hope that if something was good enough, it would be heard in the end, because the people making it would be good enough to make it heard, if that makes sense. I think everyone talks about advertising revenue dropping and everything's going to be on an iPad in 10 minutes, but I think this is an interesting example. They said, we're not going to make money off it, we're going to try and find, I think they have a Kickstarter campaign or something similar, so an online funding thing, which is a really novel way to do it, and that's, these guys obviously spend a lot of time on this, but it's not supposed to be a revenue generator. That's obviously a very different model from a magazine that has to survive on fashion ads, but I think there's enough space for everything to coexist.
That's Duncan Campbell. Duncan, thank you very much for coming on The Stack today. That brings us to the end of this edition of the programme. A special thanks to Duncan Campbell here. Our producer was David Pleasant. And behind the glass here at Midori House was our studio manager, Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, drop me a note. We're at info@monocle.com. And remember, we'll return next Saturday at the very same time. You can listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes. We do make it easy for you. But for now, until next time on the programme, that is all. It's goodbye from me. Thanks for listening.